This week on Vox Talks, a new economic history of World War II. Welcome to Vox Talks from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. This week, politicians have been remembering that it's 80 years since the outbreak of World War II. In 2020, Vox EU will be publishing a book about the economic history of the war. But between now and then, we will be publishing each of the chapters in a book one by one and inviting you to discuss them. The editors of this project are Stephen Broadberry and Mark Harrison. And in this special episode of Vox Talks, we'll be hearing from some of the authors who will be contributing their research. But first, when I spoke to Mark about the project, I asked him if there are any remaining mysteries about the economic history of the Second World War.
Well, this is not going to be a conventional thriller because we already know the outcome. I think it's more the kind of thriller where you start with the murder and can't really imagine how we got there, and that has to be explained. At the root of the war, there's a kind of mystery, which is the same as it always was. You've got two sides, one of which had a strategy of aggression that was based on surprise and deception and rapid movement. It wasn't supposed to lead to generalized destruction. And the other side has a strategy of deterrence that's based on alliance and bombers. Bombers are the first modern deterrent. I mean, that's why neutralist, isolationist America was building bombers, so that they wouldn't have to go to Europe again. And then the deterrence fails, and Blitzkrieg worked well at first, but then fails too, and the result is a war that kills 50 million people. And the effects are still with us today in ways that are seen and also ways that are unseen. In some ways, I think to me, the most novel findings that we'll cover will be the unseen ways in which the war still affects us. So Pauline Grosjean will write about how exposure to violence affects political norms and preferences in European societies today. Jim Robinson's going to write about how the elimination of Jews from European society also had similar but distinct effects. And I think it's those things that are with us that we can't really be aware of in a direct way because they're things that happened long ago and they're about people who are no longer here.
Do you know what's going to be in the book yet?
Not yet. What I think we do know is that there are going to be both new topics and traditional topics. Economic historians are continually expanding into new fields. And when I first became interested in this topic 40 years ago, it was a struggle just to describe production and consumption in the major countries at war in a consistent and comparative framework. Now we've got research on all kinds of other new fields, like how did the Great Depression play into the rise of right-wing populism across Europe and the coming to power of National Socialism in Germany. Germany fought its war for territory for colonial settlement, and also they thought their colonial gains would make the war self-financing. And did they succeed, and what were the effects on the occupied people? You've got the fact that the war exposed hundreds of millions of people to famine. So we need to know about the mechanisms that led to famine and how the magnitude of famine deaths compared to the battle deaths. Some countries held to neutrality while their neighbors went to war or were occupied. And so we need to know about how they maintained relations with both sides without becoming targets for aggression by one side or the other. For our own discipline, economists played a much more practical and hands-on role in World War II than in World War I, and so it's nice to find out what they did and how that affected the post-war development of our profession. But I think we're not going to neglect the traditional topics, economic warfare, blockade and bombing. I think this history ought to be remembered every time a Western country imposes sanctions on some other country to try to change their behavior or break their resistance, what the United States or the Western alliance wants. You know, for some people, it's a practical issue. Does it work? For others, it's a rights issue because it's always done via civilians, via the civilian economy. So civilians suffer. And when we look at World War II, economic warfare probably did work, but more slowly than people hoped and generally not in the way that they expected. How was the war decided and what was the importance of economics in that? I mean, this is a subject that continues to excite national feeling. Russians looking back, I think, often tend to see the contribution of Russia to World War II as the only good thing that happened in the 20th century. They're no longer enchanted with revolution or with communism. They're not particularly enchanted with the transition to capitalism either. So World War II is all that's left, as long as you started in 1941 and forget the fact that in 1939, the Soviet Union was Hitler's ally. These things remain controversial. They remain uppermost in people's minds. And the new ways of thinking are coming around all the time.
What are your criteria for including a chapter in this book?
I think there's a lot of personal judgment in this, but I'll speak for myself. I look for things that seem interesting and important, and do people contribute new evidence or new ways of thinking about old evidence that helps to sustain a more convincing story than the one we had before.
As Mark said, we are discussing both the economics of the war and the role of economists in it. Alan Bollard of the Victoria University of Wellington has studied the vital role of economists in the war effort in every country, and how World War II was a testing ground for many of the most important economic innovations of the 20th century.
One sees pretty quickly, when you look at how economists, the roles they've got and how they behave during World War II, you realise that the whole war is obviously not just a military and political struggle, it's an economic one as well. And so economists in some places had a very key role. They had to work out how to finance the war. They had to work out how to allocate resources, because markets were often breaking down or not able to work in those situations. They had to work out what sort of rationing techniques might work, just physical rationing or some other price type rationing when there was demand that simply couldn't be satisfied. They had to overall work out how you'd pay for the war. And in different places at different times, you see taxation being used, you see borrowing and war bonds being used, and you see inflation being used. And those three different broad systems have all got quite different implications for just who's going to end up paying for it. Is it this generation or next generation? Is it labor force? Is it different parts of business and so on? In many cases, economists had to work out what were strategic resources and work out how to access them and use them and conserve them. Sometimes they were the ones who had to try and control very big demands from military spending, very big demands from the army overall. And particularly when there were dictatorships or effectively military control, then they could be in quite difficult, sometimes quite dangerous positions. They had to understand and work out how they could input on currency control, because, you know, as Lenin said, debasing the currency was one of the best ways to debase a Western market system. And they had to work out where the bottlenecks in an economy were, how to protect them, how to continue their operation, how to rebuild them if they got damaged. The economists that I've studied ended up having very difficult lives, sometimes in the front line, sometimes just under intense political pressure and back lines. So a lot of them had very difficult times as well as very challenging ones.
When we think of war economists, Alan, a name that probably comes to most people's mind is Keynes. Is it true that World War II effectively created the system of national accounts that we're still using today?
It's partly true to think that the system of national accounts was pioneered during the war, and Keynes is certainly a key person in that. Keynes, of course, had already become famous, particularly for his general theory during the later 1930s. That very much focused on the importance of aggregate demand in an economy. And that implied that you did, in fact, need to measure the economy in some way. But his particular work about how to pay for the war really focused that down. And he was saying, well, you could pay for the war in a number of different ways, but you had to work out how much pressure the war effort was going to put on the normal operations of the economy. And generally speaking, it was understood that it would lead to a big increase in demand and overheat an economy. He wanted to estimate by how much, because he needed to estimate how much extra funding. The American-Russian emigre economist Simon Kuznets had probably done some of the pioneering work in the 1930s. But Keynes wanted to find some practical ways of estimating the size of the output gap, if you like, how much the economy was going to under pressure. And he did that by getting some colleagues to help him estimate some real numbers on the national account, some real numbers for how much the British economy in particular was going to be overtaxed by the war.
World War II also had a huge personal cost for many of these economists. One of the great economists of the 20th century who suffered most in the war was Leonid Kantorovich. He applied his innovation of linear programming to the war effort in the Soviet Union, but I think it was with limited success.
Leonid Kantorovich had a very tough time during the war. War started off with Kantorovich out on the ice road that was the only way of breaking the siege of Leningrad And he was the one doing the mathematical estimates of the ice thickness and how much trucks and cargo you could actually bring in safely to keep that city going. And that was indicative of the sort of war that he had. He had invented linear programming before the war. He'd done it for industrial applications, for a plywood factory, which was trying to get much more efficient in its use of limited supplies of plywood. And he decided he could use that technique to try and optimize Soviet planning for the economy as a whole, which, of course, was very important for the war effort. However, that's where he ran into problems. He ran into problems with Stalin. He ran into problems with other Marxist-Leninist ideologues. And as far as they were concerned, they were tied into the labor theory of value. And when someone like Kantorovich came along and said, well, using prices, you can actually get a better, more efficient allocation of resources. And he very quickly was warned off that. And in fact, some of his colleagues were pulled away to the gulags. But he brought this work back out with the thaw under Khrushchev in the 1950s and 60s.
And eventually winning the Nobel Prize.
And he did, yes.
Meanwhile, in the US, the war effort also provided an application for Vasily Leontief's input-output analysis, I think.
Another St. Petersburg boy. He emigrated to the United States and developed this input-output technique, which of course was a way of mapping an economy. And it was quite attractive to non-economists because they could understand where inputs went in, how they were used in the economy, and what the outputs were. And it was used by Franklin Delano Roosevelt's labor secretary to try and model what labor supplies would look like after the war in the United States. But more to the point, it was also picked up by the economists and the generals in Europe in the Allied bombing effort for strategic bombing to try and identify where the weak points of an economy were, in this case in Germany, and work out therefore where they would focus their strategic bombing. Would it be on industry? If it was going to be trying to find the weak points in industry, would those be actually on the factories, or would they be on the transport links? And the Allied war effort relied quite heavily on these broad understandings of where they should aim the bombs and also which particular parts of the German economy were most vulnerable to this. So it had quite a big impact through on that. Later in life, Leontief used his input-output technique to try and work out the dividends for peace.
Another of the groundbreaking economists who's remembered for his contribution during the war years is William Beveridge, whose report, published in 1942, was arguably the origin of the modern welfare state. Here he is speaking at the time about how that welfare state would ensure equality of opportunity for ordinary people.
Sir William Beveridge is the recognised authority on present-day and post-war problems.
The national minimum is a peculiarly British idea. It means that no one is to fall below a certain standard.
Now, the idea of a social safety net might not have been entirely British, and it certainly isn't now, but one thing we can't dispute is that World War II globally had an important effect on public attitudes to inequality. Walter Schiedel at Stanford argues that one of the most profound effects of World War II was in reducing inequality. But I asked him, hadn't the First World War and the Great Depression already done that?
That's certainly true. In some European countries, inequality had gone down in World War One, in France, in Britain, in Germany, right after when everything started melting down. But very little in North America, for instance, in the US. In the US, inequality peaked in the 1920s, the Roaring Twenties. It did go down in the US during the Great Depression because of the economic fallout and then thanks to the New Deal, but not so much in other countries. What makes World War II really stand out globally is that inequalities in income and wealth were reduced consistently across most of the world. In all European countries we have data for, in North America, in East Asia, in Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, China, because of the communist takeover. The only exception, the exception that proves the rule, is Latin America, because Latin America was not meaningfully involved in World War II. So in that respect, the Second World War was truly unique as a leveling force.
So if I was in the global 1% in 1939, Walter, How did World War II affect my income?
It would have depended on where you were. You would not have wanted to be rich in Japan at the time, because there the share of the highest earning 1% in all income collapsed from 20% to 6% in just a few years. It wasn't quite as dramatic in other countries, but so very significant. You would have lost about half of your share in Canada, a third in Britain, maybe a quarter in the US. So wherever you look, the richest, the highest earning people would have lost quite dramatically.
Was this decline in income for the rich solely due to the destruction of their assets, or were there other factors at play here?
Physical destruction is obviously a big deal in World War II, but it's geographically limited to places like Germany or France or Japan or Central Europe, where often we don't have data, but you don't find it in North America or in Australia, where inequality also went down. Piketty pointed out some years ago that capital was a major issue, that capital assets investments were devalued because of the dislocations of war and because of government intervention. Returns on capital dropped or were negative for a few years. And in many places, you have something like a planned economy. You have massive state intervention to sustain the war effort with controls on wages, prices, dividends, nationalization schemes, coupled with extremely high taxes on high earners and large estates, north of 90% in North America on the highest incomes, and in many other countries. Some countries suffer severe inflation that wipes out assets. And of course, it may seem perverse, but for the first time since the Depression of the 30s, there was full employment because of conscription, the war industry, huge demand for unskilled labor, and reduced the gap in earnings between people with a lot of education and everybody else. And all these factors converged in driving down inequality in income and wealth, in many cases dramatically.
After the war, had attitudes to fairness and inequality changed?
Well, it's hard to pin down quantitatively because it's hard to measure attitudes, but there's certainly a shared experience of sacrifice in war and so on, with an expectation that now things had to get better in terms of social welfare, healthcare, education, the social safety net, and so on. And you need two things to build a welfare state. You need the political will and the ability of the state to do so. And thanks to high taxes and the organizational experience gained in the war, states were able to institute very ambitious programs, and the political will was also being supplied, regardless of party affiliation. That reflects changes in attitude. You can use labor unionization as a proxy. In many countries, union membership peaked in the late 1940s. That's a reflection of people's will to change society, but in turn, that changed and affected their attitudes as well, ensuring that equalization didn't just stop suddenly after 1945, but continued for about a generation of the 70s and 80s. There are any number of reasons for this, but attitude certainly played a significant role in this process.
As Mark mentioned, millions did not survive to see these changes, not because they were killed in fighting, but because they starved to death. In Leningrad, for example, diary entries document a war against starvation that millions lost.
When will this torture end? I no longer believe that there will be an
I have become just bones and wrinkled skin.
A mother wishes death for her child and a husband for his wife. The whole city has become this way because the battle for life has brought despair to every living individual.
I am becoming weaker by the day, and my last reserves of strength are declining with each
hour. I would eat anything right now, but I have nothing.
Cormac O'Grada of University College Dublin has studied the famines of World War II. I asked him how many people died in this way.
Well, I reckon between 15 and 20 million, which means that almost as many died of famine as died on the battlefield. World War II was very different than wars before because it was a question of total war. So you have civilian casualties from bombing and collateral damage, but also, like, very, very importantly, from famine. And people died pretty much all over the world from famine, except that for the most part, the warring parties themselves were safe from famine. So if you think of Germany, Japan, Britain, and the US, they escaped without suffering from famine during the war. The main warring country for which this is not true, of course, is the Soviet Union. we'd suffered more from famine than anywhere else. Probably half of the famine casualties during World War II occurred in the Soviet Union.
When we think of the Soviet resistance against the Nazis, Cormac, many of us think first of Stalingrad, but as those readings showed, millions of civilians also died in the blockade of Leningrad.
Well, the Lenin blockade is very well documented. It lasted up to 3 years. It was at its most intense during the winter and spring of 1941-42. Of the people who remained in the city, probably about a million, up to a million, that would be nearly a third of the total, died before the blockade was lifted and completely lifted in 1944. And these people died of literal starvation. They did not die, as used to happen during famines in the past, of infectious diseases, because the authorities were pretty good at ensuring that infectious diseases did not spread. So you do not have thousands and thousands of people dying of typhus, for example, which was the case during other World War II famines in more economically backward areas.
One of the most controversial episodes of famine at this time, which we now know a lot more about thanks to the work of Amartya Sen and others, was in Bengal, where I think up to 3 million died. Was the Bengal famine a direct consequence of World War II?
Absolutely. There had been food shortages in Bengal before 1939-1940, and Bengal was spared famine. Problem was that there was a shortage of food. This is contested, but this is my belief. But the authorities chose basically to ignore it and to argue that there was enough food for everybody in Bengal. The problem was maldistribution. So the mantra at the time was sufficiency, sufficiency, sufficiency. And this ignored the fundamental problem, which became clear really only in the late spring and summer of 1943, that there was a genuine shortage of food. And the authorities chose to delay relief to Bengal, arguing that wartime priorities were more important. So these people who died in Bengal were unwilling casualties in what we would deem a just war. But for them, it was something that didn't really involve them. And they died in their millions.
Did famine happen at this time because food was requisitioned or simply because there just wasn't enough of it?
Well, there was a bit of both, but notoriously there was a lot of requisitioning and theft of food in the occupied Soviet Union and also in places like Java and in China, where the Japanese occupiers simply took what food they could lay their hands on. And it wasn't just a question of requisitioning, however, because the war created such dislocation that it made it difficult for people to produce food. And of course, if people are suffering from malnutrition, that means, of course, that as workers on the farm, they're going to be less effective. So you have this cumulative kind of effect of war causing starvation and starvation in turn reducing agricultural output. But I would say that probably for the most part, famine deaths are due to the violence of requisitioning and over-procurement of food.
Economic historians, they've also identified that for those who survive famines, the effects may last a lifetime, haven't they?
Well, that's right. I mean, this is something that began not with economic historians, but with epidemiologists and medical historians. And the starting point was a fairly small famine by World War II standards in the Western Netherlands towards the end of the war, when about 20,000 people died. Now, that famine is extremely well documented, and people began to use it as a kind of a natural experiment, if you like, to test the so-called fetal origins hypothesis, the notion that if you were unlucky enough to be in the womb during or towards the end of the war, then this would have adverse consequences for you in later life. And a great deal of research has been inspired by that work on the Netherlands. It suggests that people who were in the womb during the war were more likely to contract schizophrenia, diabetes, cardiac diseases. These are the main diseases associated with the fetal origins hypothesis. And the evidence is fairly robust, although I would argue that it has been maybe overhyped. Then economic historians have gone on from this and looked at people who were young, not just waiting to be born during the war. So they've looked at children and addressed economic outcomes rather than medical outcomes, and have argued that if you were very young in 1945, 46, 47, then you were less likely to be well-educated, you were less likely to have a good job 20, 30, 40 years later.
These are just three of the contributions you'll be able to read over the next year. But I asked Mark Harrison, does studying the economic history of World War II have any relevance for the problems that we face today?
Definitely. It matters for the modern world. And I think there are several things that have practical importance today. One is to understand how deterrence works and when it fails. And the only evidence that we have on this comes from history. One interpretation of the Japanese decision to attack the United States in 1941 is that the United States applied sanctions to the Japanese economy. The Japanese leaders had two choices: give up their imperial pretensions on China and Korea, or to break out, and they decided to break out. So the response to sanctions in that case was a widening of the war. When we think about how we apply sanctions to other economies today and the options that sanctioned economies face, history has a lot to tell us, which is often forgotten. I think the unseen consequences of the war are very persistent and are still with us today. People who have no first-hand memory of the war, who might know little or nothing about what happened, their world is still shaped by the attitudes handed down through their families, through their neighbours, and by the missing people around them who we cannot see. These things are still important today, and there are direct policy lessons as well. So I think that we have a lot still to learn.
So look out for these columns and more on VoxEU in the coming months. The ones we featured today are Economists at War by Alan Bollard, Total War as a Great Leveller by Walter Schiedel, and The Famines of the Second World War by Cormac O'Grada. The diary excerpts that you heard were from a powerful book called The War Within, Diaries from the Siege of Leningrad, and that's by Alexis Perry. We also heard from Sir William Beveridge, and if you want to hear more about the impact of the Beveridge Report and its relevance today, then on the 7th of June I spoke to Minouche Shafiq, who's the director of the London School of Economics, about exactly that subject, and that Vox Talk is called The Future of the Welfare State. This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. You won't want to miss any episode, so subscribe on your podcast platform. And remember, you can always find our archive at voxeu.org/vox-talks.